The dinner was a nightmare. Santan sat at the bottom of the long table and smiled brightly, though her eyes burned with shame and the bastard in her belly felt like an adder coiled and ready to strike. The tall, elderly man beside her droned on in a particularly rasping and irritating tone, directing his monologue almost exclusively at Santan. His bald head had been turned by the sun to the colour of a plover's egg, but his eyes were strangely lifeless, like those of a marble statue. Santan could not concentrate on what he was saying, and it became unintelligible, as though he were speaking an unknown language. Her mind wandered off to pluck and worry at this new threat that had formed up so suddenly, a threat to her entire existence and that of her son. She knew that Anna was right. Neither the General nor Gary, Courtney, could allow another bastard into Tirnascral. Even if they were able to condone what she had done, and it was beyond reason or hope that they could, even then they could not allow her to bring disgrace and scandal, not only upon Michael's memory, but upon the entire family. It was not possible. Anna's way was the only escape open to her. She jumped in her seat and almost screamed aloud. Below the level of the dinner table, the man beside her had placed his hand upon her thigh. "Excuse me, Papa." She pushed back her chair hurriedly, and Gary looked down the length of the table with concern. "I must go through for a moment," and she fled into the kitchen. Anna saw her distress and ran to meet her, then led her into the pantry. She locked the door behind them. "Hold me, please, Anna. I am so confused and afraid. And that awful man," she shuddered. Anna's arms quieted her, and after a while she whispered, "You are right, Anna. We must get rid of it."
"We'll talk about it tomorrow," Anna told her gently.
"Now bathe your eyes with cold water and go back to the dining room before you make a scene." Santan's rebuff had served its purpose, and the tall, bald-headed mining magnate did not even glance at her when she came back to her seat beside him. He was addressing the woman on his other side, but the rest of the company was listening to him with the attention due to one of the richest men in the world.
"Those were the days," he was saying. "The country was wide open, a fortune under every stone, by gad. Bonato started with a box of cigars to trade, bloody awful cigars too, and when Rhodes brought him out, he gave him a cheque for £3 million, the largest cheque ever issued up to that time, though I can tell you I myself have written a few bigger since then."
"And how did you start, Sir Joseph?"
£5 in my pocket and a nose to sniff out a real diamond from a schlenter. That's how I got my start."
"And how do you do that, Sir Joseph? How do you tell a real diamond?"
"The quickest way is to dip it into a glass of water, my dear. If it comes out wet, it's a schlenter. If it comes out dry, it's a diamond."
The words passed Santan without seeming to leave any impression, for she was so preoccupied, and Gary was signalling her from the head of the table that it was time to take the ladies through. However, Robinson's words must have made a mark deep in her subconscious, for the next afternoon, as she sat in the gazebo staring unseeingly out across the sun-drenched lawns, fiddling miserably with Harney's necklace, rubbing the stones between her fingers, almost without conscious thought, she suddenly leaned over the table and from the crystal carafe poured a tumbler full of spring water. Then she lifted the necklace over the tumbler and slowly lowered it into the water. After a few seconds, she lifted it out and studied it distractedly. The coloured stones glistened with water, and then suddenly her heart began to race. The white stone, the huge crystal in the centre of the necklace, was dry. She dropped the necklace back into the water and pulled it out again. Her hand began to shake. Like the breast of a swan, shining white, The stone had shed even the tiniest droplets, although it glistened more luminously than the wet stones that surrounded it. Guiltily she looked around her, but Shasa slept on his back with a thumb deep in his mouth, and the lawns were deserted in the noonday heat. For the third time, she lowered the necklace into the glass, and when the white stone came out dry once again, she whispered softly,
"Honey, my beloved old grandmother, will you save us again? It is possible that you are still watching over me?"